Hare Krishna. So it's a pleasure to be here in New Dwarka, this famous historical temple. So I thought I might actually say a few words on magic, witchcraft, and religion. Is that okay? The first thing that occurred to me about this is that we could ask a general question, why are these three topics grouped together? And in a sense, in our modern age, of course, at any time in history, it's the modern age for those people. So at our particular time, and modernity is not something unique to us, it's just that we happen to be alive now. So I thought it was interesting that grouping these three topics together, magic, witchcraft, and religion, itself, and I think that it's an anthropology course, so we could take a step back and ask the simple question, why is it that at a particular point in time that this grouping is logical and reasonable and is a normal topic of study in a university, a Western university? Why these three topics together? And I would say the most obvious point that occurs to me is that they are all, in a sense, you could say, epistemological underdogs. And by that I mean the word epistemological, there's a Greek word episteme, which means knowledge. And so epistemology is the logos, the logic of knowledge. Like how do you know? You know, what does it mean? What is knowledge? What is a valid way of acquiring knowledge? What is valid knowledge? And so on. And so at the present time, because of the overwhelming practical success in external things, the overwhelming practical success of technology in important fields such as medicine, I mean, all of us have received significant benefit from modern medical science. I mean, personally, I'm not a big fan of pain, either in myself or other people, and I'm only too happy to find out that somebody invented something to deal with my pain. So all of us are benefiting from that. And also, if you study history, we see that in many parts of the world, at many times in history, people lived under very difficult conditions. And there was tremendous suffering, and we can still see it in some parts of the world. So the fact that, in fact, it's been said that never were so many people able to live as comfortably or peacefully as they are in at least certain parts of the world, certainly not everywhere. So in many ways, I mean, we could talk about psychology. We could talk about, what's your field, biotechnology, yes. You know, which I've said that biotechnology, it's like the second coming, because now the lame can walk and the blind can see through biotechnology. So I am not anti-science or anti-rationality or anything like that. However, there's a tendency when somebody wins big, when someone sort of is king of the hill or has power, it's said that power corrupts. And power corrupts not only politicians, who I guess nowadays are sort of pre-corrupted, but still it's a general fact that power corrupts. And so when a certain group of people, in this case you could say scientists or in general those who use certain rational means to pursue various scholarly fields, the fact of taking power, and I'll say what I mean by taking power, leads to, inevitably, at least among certain people in that community, a type of arrogance. And as we know, arrogance is blinding. That the more anyone in any field of life is arrogant or proud, the more that person will tend to miss a lot of reality. And so when I say power, I mean that in every society, In every society makes arrangements to socialize, indoctrinate, acculturate, They're young. In other words, people, men and women, marry, they have children, and they want to bring the children into the same moral and cultural system that they live in, you want, whatever that may be. And so for that purpose, people create schools. Although one of the Republican candidates says we don't really need schools, but that's another issue. But most people would agree that we do need schools. So now in America, anyway, I don't want to go into too much of the history because... Anyway, I won't indulge my own intellectual curiosities here, but the fact is that we have public schools. And so if you look at public education, if you look at public education and what is permissible and not permissible to teach in a public school, whether, you know, it's K-12 or colleges, then you get a very clear idea of what sort of, so to speak, the reigning epistemology is. What's the official epistemology, what's the official knowledge system which is in power at the present time? And despite what people privately may believe, in fact, we can say that basically today, anything which, almost anything which is not, let us say, empirical or if I can use it in a non-judgmental sense, materialistic, is a private matter. The public sphere, the public field of education is reserved for the material. And anything which is not material, and there's a word for that, the physical, and then beyond the physical is called the metaphysical. So in a sense, anything which is not physical, material, is metaphysical, that's reserved for the private sphere. And of course, we have the freedom in this country to form communities, to create private schools, and teach children or other people whatever we like. But in the public sector today belongs to the material. The material, or the, in other words, material methods of knowing. And so, therefore, in that historical situation that we live in, that's what basically magic, witchcraft, and religion have to do with each other. It's sort of a coalition of the unwilling, you might say. Because these three types of human behavior or human interest share one thing in common. They all claim that there is something which is objectively true beyond ordinary material science. So that's, in a sense, what these three things have in common. Now, it's very much, historically specific, because, for example, if you went to a school in the Middle Ages, you went to a college, you might take a course in, let's say, magic, witchcraft, and science. Because in the Middle Ages, it was, sort of speak, the central public way of understanding things was religious and spiritual. And so you'd have the, so to speak, the underdogs or the, you know, the foreigners, the epistemological foreigners would be the, let's say, magic, witchcraft, and science, and material science. But because we live in this age, it's magic, witchcraft, and religion. So I wanted to make that first point, which is even the way people think nowadays about fields of study is historically specific. Now, I wish to make a further distinction between, hope I'm not getting in trouble, I'll never be invited to Morehead College, but anyway, I want to make a further distinction between magic, witchcraft, and religion. There's one very important characteristic which separates them. At least, again, using sort of general conceptions of what these words mean. And that is that if you know your Harry Potter, and I assume you all do, then you know that magic and witchcraft are morally neutral. And by that I mean that, let's say someone has or claims to have magic power, or is can do witchcraft or warlock craft. That's actually, isn't that sort of like gender problem there? Shouldn't be like, what about warlock craft? But anyway, so if you, and you find the same thing in the Vedic literature that we are presenting. For example, there's a famous book called the Atharva Veda, one of the four Vedas, which is kind of involves some of this stuff of kind of putting spells on people and things like that. And therefore, even in ancient times in India, the Atharva Veda was sort of, it was a Veda, it was okay, but it was seen a little, askance. In fact, that's why, for example, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says in chapter 9, Evam Trayi Dharma Manuprapana. He talks about followers of the Vedas as those who follow the three, the Rig, Sam, and Yajur Vedas. Because those three Vedas were actually sort of for the people who were more spiritually minded or religious minded. And then there was, you know, people kind of into magic. Then there, so that's why Krishna talks about the three. In the, anyway, so either in the Vedic culture that we are engaged with or in any other culture, to say that someone's dabbling in or dedicated to magic or witchcraft tells us nothing about the person's moral position. In other words, it can be used for good or evil, and often is used for good or evil. I mean, think of the dark side of the force. So, on the other hand, religion, when it is kind of like healthy, let us say, I mean, you know, going into a religious school and shooting children, I would say, is not a healthy form of religion. So the next time someone, you know, so if someone tells me that, you know, you have to tolerate all religions, which I certainly do, I tolerate all religions that I think pass even like minimal moral standards, but shooting school children in the name of God, I think, which just happened in Toulouse, France, I think is not an acceptable form of religion. So, therefore, we're not being, I would say, sectarian or fanatical in saying that religion which is worthy of the name, should be morally positive, should be morally good. In fact, the word religion comes from the Latin religare, which means, of course, in Latin, to chant Hare Krishna. Just kidding. Sort of. Anyway, religare in Latin means to reconnect. So actually, the word religion comes from a root which means the same as the word yoga. So the word yoga means also to connect with God. And it is, I think, an assumption, it is a conviction of most religious people that God is good, that God is not an evil genius who is somehow controlling us, that God is actually morally good and positive. And therefore, to connect with that supremely good entity means that connection should lead one to virtue. Just like Prabhupada's example that if you put iron in fire, iron, you know, is very different than fire, but if you put iron in fire, if you have enough fire, obviously if you have just a little fire, you know, the fire will go out. But if you have a big fire and you put iron in fire, the iron is transformed into fire. It takes on the fiery qualities. The iron takes on the fiery qualities of the fire. So in the same way, if anyone in any tradition, any religion, actually has a strong connection with God, then just like iron and fire, it is to be expected. It is to be required, really, to verify or justify the claim that one is strongly connected to God, that one becomes virtuous. And virtuous simply means that we will always act for the greatest good of ourselves and others. And we will avoid unnecessarily harming anyone. And I say unnecessarily harming because, for example, you could say roughly to harm someone is to cause them suffering or pain. But parents take their children for medical treatment, which sometimes is uncomfortable, or they have to get a shot, which may cause pain, but it's for a greater good. So causing someone trouble, if it's clearly for greater good, then that still may be a virtuous act. Anyway, so I think religion obviously, especially in America, in a free society, anyone can do anything and say that's my religion. But sometimes there's a tendency to confuse what is legal and what is reasonable. So that if something is legal, then it must be as reasonable as anything else, because if you ever claim that anything is better than anything else in any area of life, you could commit the greatest of all sins, which is to negatively impact someone else's self-esteem. Of course, but the fact is that, let's say, helping innocent children is morally superior to shooting them. So there is a right and wrong, there is good and bad, and so religion I think when it's being done right, whatever the religion may be, it should espouse, it should promote virtue and goodness, and it should lead those who take it seriously to goodness. Whereas magic and witchcraft won't necessarily do that. In fact, it's just a force. The idea behind magic and witchcraft is they're simply powers that exist in the universe, and like any other power, one may use it for good or evil. Well, that was my, I got the bully pulpit here, so those are a few words on the magic, witchcraft, and religion. So also to make sure our students here get their money's worth, they had to, you know, cost money for gas to come here from. So I want to say something about what we're doing specifically. And also I'd like to sort of jump into an interesting topic and talk about these deities, these in America, being an idol is very good if you're in a music competition, but very bad if it's a religious icon. So it's context sensitive, right? So because what we're doing here, obviously worshiping and bowing down and things like that, so why are we doing that? And are we, I mean, because the reason I mention this is because in religious traditions that come from the Middle East, there tends to be the idea that this is all, practically the greatest outrage that one can perform in the name of religion to, so to speak, worship an idol. And I would like to address this not dogmatically, not by saying that, you know, our God can beat up your God or something like that, but rather, which actually was a way that people used to argue about religion in some parts of the world, and still do in some parts of the world. But address it philosophically. I taught a course in the history of Indian religions at the University of Florida a few years ago, and I made the following point, that the sort of the categorical rejection of an appearance of God in a visible form is connected to the environmental disaster that we're going through on Earth. So how do I connect these things? I don't. It's age-related. Just kidding. So I'd like to make this point that, because first of all, take, let's say, an idol, a deity, an icon, whatever you want to call it. And so at the simplest, let's say, unphilosophical level, it's an object, it's a visible object originally made out of some physical material. And in the case of the spiritual traditions that we are involved with, typically the deities are made of wood, of marble, carved of wood or of marble, and what did I leave out? Metal, of course, metal. Cast in metal. So let's get a little philosophical here and ask the simple philosophical question, what are wood, metal, and stones like marble? What are they? And in a philosophical sense, obviously you could say, well, you know, you give just a dictionary definition, but in a philosophical sense, what are these materials? And so we could begin by saying these are material, this is energy. It's material energy. And so then we ask the next philosophical question, which, by the way, physics hasn't yet figured out because they keep going to subatomic particles and they just sort of always end up in question marks. But what is it? What is energy? In an ultimate sense, what is energy? You can talk about energy, you know, physically or in terms of molecules or atoms or subatomic particles. But ultimately, what is it? Whatever the components are, whatever the smallest particle is, what is energy? And that leads to another question. Assuming for this discussion there's a God, because now I'm entering into sort of an interreligious controversy. And so it's especially, let's say, certain people who themselves take God seriously and seek to worship God that may object to this form of worship. in fact, do object in the strongest terms. And so therefore, for the purpose of this discussion, we can assume that there's a God because it's a discussion among people who are worshiping God. So the question arises, what is the relationship between God and energy? What is the relationship between God and energy? That's what you could say, a theological or a philosophical question. Now, there was a view, or there still is a view, among certain circles, and I don't mean to bash anyone else. I'm not claiming anything as like a false religion. It's just a philosophical discussion. So there is a view among certain people that matter, material energy, you know, earth, water, fire, hydrogen, oxygen, whatever, is somehow morally evil, intrinsically bad. There's something intrinsically bad about nature, about the natural world. Somehow the natural world is somehow bad. And therefore, since God is the holy of holies, God is the holiest, and since material nature is somehow intrinsically bad, to claim that the holiest and the most impure, the dirtiest, the holiest and the most impure have somehow been brought into intimate contact is blasphemy. And so therefore, to claim that God can appear in a material form or a material object, never mind the burning bush of the Old Testament, that's a sort of, I guess, a theological glitch there. But anyway, so the idea here is that for example, let's say you were going into a church or a synagogue or a temple, and you had very dirty clothes on. I mean, that would be inappropriate. It would be inappropriate to go into any house of God, whatever the religion, if you're like, you know, say sweaty, stinky, your clothes are all dirty, not to speak of, let's say, bringing some really nasty thing into the building. I mean, something really inappropriate, something really dirty and nasty and so on. Or, for example, most people consider it to be very inappropriate to engage in certain types of activities before an altar of God, again, whatever the religion. So if you go back, the philosophical or the unstated underpinning of this idea that it is a blasphemous outrage to think that God can appear in a visible form made out of the elements of nature, to think this is an outrage is based on the notion that nature, physical nature, is somehow intrinsically bad. Not that we use it for bad purposes. I mean, for example, as we know, people use nature, whether it's nature formed into a revolver or a stick or all kinds of people use material nature to do bad things to each other. But we're talking about the nature itself, the physical nature itself. And so if you believe that the relationship between God and nature is sort of a, like, there's some type of alienation there, that God really doesn't dirty his fingers with material nature because it's bad, and there's this gulf of separation between God and the natural world, then you'll naturally think it's offensive and blasphemous and outrageous to think that you could worship God within a material form, or an apparently material form. Although actually there was a revolt, the Renaissance, even going back to the Renaissance, which was really, by the way, I won't go into this now, it was actually a rebirth of Indo-European culture, Vedic culture, but that's another topic. But in the Renaissance, some people, kind of bright people, started to say, wait a second, God has actually given us two books. Of course, the first book was the Bible. But people began to say in the Renaissance that actually God has given us two books. One book is the Bible, the other is the book of nature. And that nature is not bad, in fact, it's God's handiwork. There's a whole history of that view going back to pre-Christian times. But in any case, from our point of view, our approach to this, like what is the relation between God and nature, is, as Lord Chaitanya, who's Krishna himself, as he pointed out, Beda Beda, that because everything that exists emanates from God, it emanates from God, therefore everything that exists is somehow in some way intimately connected to God because it's his own energy. In fact, there's a statement in the Upanishads that Prabhupada always quoted that says, and if I can remember it, you'll actually get to hear it. Yes. Parasya Shakti, here it is. Follow the bouncing chakra. Parasya Shaktir Vibhidhaiva Shuyate. That the Lord, God, has an energy in the singular, Parashakti. But that energy is Vibhidha. It is diverse. It manifests in many different ways. So, if you have this understanding, as Krishna says in the Gita, Aham Sarvasya Prabhava, I'm the source of everything. Everything emanates from me. Pravartate is a word translated emanates, which literally means it goes forth. Everything goes forth from me. And so therefore, if we go back to our original question, what is matter? What is material nature? It is the energy, the power, the glory of God. It comes from God, or Krishna. And therefore, rather than material nature being something sort of hopelessly alienated from and hopelessly estranged from God, it's God's own energy. And therefore the question becomes, can God appear within his own power, within his own energy? And that doesn't sound so blasphemous. Now, going back to environmentalism, if you take the view that nature is intrinsically bad and therefore it's blasphemous to ever juxtapose God with nature since God is the most holy, then what's your attitude going to be toward the environment if you think nature is just like nasty and bad? Well, read history and find out. So the environmental mess that we're in came to, and you still find people saying that. I mean, we still have political candidates in this country who say that, who think that, you know, any attempt to save the earth and environmentalism is itself almost blasphemous. It's like, you know, over my dead corporation, you'll protect the earth. So that if at any given time, let's say, environmental principle reduces anyone's profit, it's evil. It's, you know, it's like satanic environmentalism. So when you have this idea that nature is bad, then you just kind of use it and whatever. But when you see nature as coming from God, when you see nature as divine, we may misuse it, but nature itself is actually spiritual and divine, then of course it gives you a very different attitude. I'll tell you one story, which not a story, it's some information that I came across when I was doing my own doctoral dissertation. That in South India, there was the Vaishnav community, the Vaikonasa community, which are actually mentioned in the Rig Veda, they're mentioned in the Bhagavatam also. Anyway, they're an ancient Vaishnav community, and when they were going to build a temple, a Deva Griha, which means house of God, when they were going to build a temple to worship God, you know, when you build, you have to level the ground. You don't build things on slanted ground. So you had to level the ground, and they didn't have tractors back then. Somehow managed to have meaningful lives. So the way they would level the ground is by plowing. And so because they were going to build a sacred building, house of God, you couldn't use the same plow you used for your turnips and potatoes. So therefore they would carve a new plow. Now, carving a new plow meant you had to cut a tree down. And so cutting a tree down means destroying a community. Because as we know, even as Lord Chaitanya talks about trees and what is it, Tarora, these even more tolerant than a tree, that a tree is actually the center of an entire community. There are birds, squirrels, you know, insects, people, you know, all kinds of creatures take shade, even human beings. So really a tree is the center of a living community, and the tree itself is alive. And so therefore, before cutting the tree down, the people doing that had to humbly acknowledge the harm they were causing. In a sort of unavoidable harm because you have to build things, and they would pray, they would sincerely pray and do various things for the eternal welfare of the souls who are being dislodged, disturbed by that process of cutting a tree down. Now, compare that to modern factory tree farms. And this was actually an international, this was a global understanding in before. For example, in the Amazon and Caribbean region, there were certain indigenous peoples before the Spanish came and civilized everyone by killing them. So for example, if you wanted to build a new canoe, because a lot of people lived on, you know, waterways and rivers and everything in the Amazon. So the same thing, you actually had to get permission from the goddess of the forest to cut a tree down and build a canoe. And so there's been what has been what is called the disenchantment of nature, that rather than seeing nature as something which is divine, which is pervaded by Krishna, by God, as Krishna says in chapter 9 of the Gita, Maya tatam idam sarvam, that I pervade this entire universe. So rather than seeing nature as something which is pervaded by the presence of God and by those who serve God, I mean, some people think it's evil, the idea that God should allow any sincere souls to assist him in managing the universe, as if that somehow threatens the principle of monotheism. Anyway, so there's a whole history to that. So there's a history to everything. So the idea is that if you see God, however you understand God, we, of course, see that God, that the original form of God is Krishna. But if you see God pervading nature, and you see every material thing as somehow the property of God, Isha Vasimi Dang Sarvam, and that we are humble servants of God, then it's just a very different way of being in the world. It's a very different way of being in the world. And ultimately, it gives you the freedom to understand that just as God pervades everything, he can also appear in a particular deity form. So the question is really not, from the ontological or philosophical point of view, the question is not, is God present in these visible forms? Because even in, I mean, so many religions, practically all the major world religions accept that in some way or other, God pervades the world, that God is present everywhere. So that's not the question, is God present here? The question is God willing to accept your devotion and worship through this particular form? You know what we're going to say, because we're the Hare Krishna movement. So, in fact, Prabhupada used to give the example that there may be many boxes in the street, but a particular box is authorized by the U.S. Postal Service, which may actually be in business for a few more years before they finally give up. And so there's a post box, you know, there's a box authorized by the post office. You put your letter there, the letter will go. So anyway, I'd like to again thank the students for visiting, and I tried to explain what we're doing here. We're also chanting names of God. This is a non-sectarian process for connecting to God, Krishna. The idea is that God is present in his name. If you study if you study world religions, you'll find that practically in every major world religion, there is the notion that God is present in his name. Actually, you find that throughout world religion. To give one simple example, if you look at the Old Testament, when the first temple was built in Jerusalem, the Old Testament says it was built as a temple to the name of God. That as God lives in heaven, his name lives in the temple. And you'll find this throughout world religions. So, anyway, thank you very much. These are some of the points I wanted to make. So we're chanting the names of God to connect with Krishna and to be in his presence. So any questions on these points? Yes. Regarding what? Oh, talk to me after the class. I didn't want to. There's a tendency in traditions from the Middle East to feel this way. Yes.
Religion were metaphysical, but right. Then also pointed out that the physical is tied or emanates from God. So it got me thinking. You mentioned a moral that there's a moral compass involved with the word religion. And does the word good come from the word God?
Does the word good? I'm not sure, but the word God comes from Sanskrit. Did you know that? Yeah, for a slight additional fee, I'll give you that. I'll explain very quickly. If you can tolerate a little historical linguistics here, I'll make this very brief. There is a tendency that a Sanskrit H, the letter H, becomes a European G. And there are many examples of that. For example, the Sanskrit word Vahana means a vehicle, like Christian Vahana. That becomes German Wagen, as in Volkswagen, or Peugeot, which is a French car. Anyway, so Vahan becomes Wagen. Then, for example, the Sanskrit word aham means I. So you change the Sanskrit word aham, I, to G, and you get the word Greek word ego. Or, for example, if you take the Sanskrit word maha, great, change the H to G, you get the Latin magna, like magnificent, magna carta, magnify, and so on. And similarly, there's an ancient word in the Rig Veda for God, which is hutam, from the word to invoke or offer sacrifice. So hutam means the one who's invoked. And so if you change the H to G from huta, you get got, and then God. So, yes, English, so you can see the influence of Sanskrit. Yes. Yes. Oh, microphone.
Witchcraft and magic being morally neutral, but religion inherently virtuous. So how do we respond when people say, well, all of the atrocities committed in the name of religion, are we denying that they're actually religious, they're truly religious?
Yes. The atrocities committed by people in the name of religion. There's a topic. Clearly, people, when they do evil things in the name of religion, are betraying their religions. If, in fact, they have a serious religion, they're betraying it. I mean, look what people do in the name of, let's say, like public servants. Like, what about if someone, let's say, is a police officer or a soldier? I mean, people do all kinds of things. Politicians who rob people blind. So the history of the world is that power corrupts people, and they will use that power sometimes for evil purposes. So in a society which takes religion seriously, in a society which takes God seriously, people who are considered to be advanced or institutions which are considered to be, let's say, authoritative in that religious realm, naturally take on power, and that power corrupts them. And so although one thing I say, there's like this cliche in our culture that, you know, religions cause so many wars. My simple question is, if all you knew about religion was the religions that came from India, would we have that cliche? Would people, if all we knew about religion was, let's say, Vedic culture, or frankly, you could almost say Asian, you almost throw Buddhism in. If that's all we knew about religion, would people say that religion caused most of the wars? Frankly, even if you look at pagan Europe, you know, we should feel solidarity with them since many people consider us to be pagans. So let's just a moment of solidarity here. So if you look at pagan Europe, there was actually religious freedom. And look at the Roman Empire, which was sort of the dominant political force for many centuries, or the Roman Republic also. And they really didn't fight religious wars. They never said that, you know, we're fighting this war to bring Zeus to Asia, or to bring Zeus to North Africa. Jupiter. Jupiter, by the way, is also Sanskrit. Because in Sanskrit, you know, we have the word Divya, which means divine, or Deva. The word Deva or Divya come from the Sanskrit root Dyu, which means heaven or divine. And Peter, you know, is father. Peter, which is the basic form of the word we say, Pita. So Jupiter, father of heaven, Jupiter. Anyway, so the Romans didn't say, like, you know, we're going to bring Jupiter here or there. They believed in their gods, but they respect, you know, there were many religions. So this idea that people, that you actually, you just kill people because they have the wrong religion. and that God, and that you have this like God who's so jealous that he really needs a 12-step program. I mean, think of it. I mean, imagine if you read in the news, I won't say the newspaper because that's like really dating myself. Let's say you read in the news that some guy had all these children and he told the children like, okay, I want you to mow the lawn and wash the car and do this and that, and they didn't do it, so he just lit them all on fire. And he did it very slowly so he didn't want to burn too quick because he wanted to really make his point. I mean, obviously, and he did his own children. I mean, obviously, you'd see that person is like the most evil monster. So, a God who tortures his own children forever for mental crimes, like you just didn't get the theology right. God would actually be a monster. And so, it actually follows, if you really believe that anyone who doesn't see God exactly as you do will be tortured forever. I mean, I wouldn't even want to be tortured for 5 seconds or 3 seconds. I mean, to be tortured for 10 seconds would probably traumatize you for the rest of your life. And how about forever? And this poor soul is screaming in agony and crying out to God, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And God just sort of sits there and, you know, turns up the heat and it goes on forever. It goes on forever. So, yes. Let me just finish one point and then we'll go back to you, okay? You're on the, what is it, on deck circle. Yeah, let me just finish this one point. That, there's a certain consistent internal logic, which is monstrous, but actually it's, so to speak, consistent. I mean, something can be logically consistent, but horribly untrue. Like if you say, for example, that all horses are birds, and all horses are birds, and all horses fly, therefore all birds fly. I mean, that's like illogical but true. But if you say, for example, anyway, it's logically consistent. It's just so. If you believe that anyone who believes in a false doctrine will be tortured forever. And so anyone who's a false preacher, it's like, you know, the laws against drug traffickers are much more heavy than the laws against drug users. And so if you are a false doctrine trafficker, and anyone who listens to you is going to just be tortured forever, then to kill that false preacher actually follows logically. That if you can't shut the guy up, and you send him to an island, then he starts, you know, preaching to the other people on the island. So there's just not enough islands for all the false preachers. So since God is going to torture these people forever, as above, so below, to be God-like, to do God's work means that start the torture now. Because that's what God's going to do, and that's what it means to walk in the path of God. I mean, you can see this is like much worse than monstrous. And so therefore, anyone's a false preacher, killing them, torturing them, it's logical. I mean, to give an example, it's sort of a horrible example, but let's say you go to pick your kid up in high school and there's one of these horrible kids that, you know, start shooting other kids. And let's say the circumstances are such, you only have one option, and that is to shoot that other kid. And you don't have the luxury of like, okay, I'll shoot him in the leg. You know, all you've got is a shotgun, and you just need to take him out. And let's say he's actually shooting innocent children. What do? I mean, you take him out. So in the same way, if someone is... So a millions of times worse than a high school killer is a false preacher if you believe that God is so evil that he's going to torture forever all those who just slightly get it wrong in someone else's eyes. So Krishna consciousness is really a great idea. Because we have what I call principled inclusivism. We are inclusive. We see God is present in many traditions. We honor and respect people who are worshiping God in different ways. And yet there are reasonable principles so that we don't have to honor and respect people that shoot school children in the name of God. So we are inclusive, but it's a principled inclusivism. Yes, you finally...
So if God is the source of everything, where does the concept of atrocities in the name of religion, the very thought, come from?
Atrocity.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, I could, in the name of anything, do anything. To say that someone... To commit an atrocity in the name of God doesn't mean you're actually carrying out the will of God.
But everything is the will of God, right?
But what?
Everything is the will of God.
No, it's not at all.
No?
No. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that, what the heck are you guys doing down here? In fact, Krishna specifically says in the Gita that I'm not responsible for the crazy things you do. He specifically says that. Nada te kasya chit papa. Krishna says, I don't take responsibility for your bad deeds, nor for your good deeds. Krishna specifically says that I don't take responsibility for that. You are making your own choices. If you choose to follow God's will and to learn about Krishna's will from his representatives, like Prabhupada, pure devotee, then we can understand actually what God really wants us to do. And then we can lead that kind of that beautiful life where at every moment we're actually acting for the highest welfare of everyone. Otherwise, let's say a rogue soldier, like just happened this tragedy in Afghanistan, you know, someone can think, well, I'm acting for my country, and just start shooting innocent people. The government doesn't accept. The government doesn't say, well, I guess that really was our will. No. Yes. Microphone?
So one specific example, when Moses comes down the hill and he's mad that they're worshiping a golden calf, is he representing a god that hates nature, or is he representing a god that is a monster?
Maybe God's a vegan.
Well, there you go. I'll buy that.
As far as the golden calf, we do have goat puja. But puja actually means to honor. This is something we should clear. Some people get a little disturbed because, well, you worship this and you worship that. You worship the guru. You worship cows. What we have to keep in mind is the word puja, as Prabhupada often translated, if you look in the Veda base, means to honor. So, for example, let's say to worship your parents means to honor them, and that's one of the commandments, to honor your father and mother. So the word, like, as in honor your father and mother, the word honor there could be translated in Sanskrit as puja. Do puja to your honor to your mother and father. So there's a simple principle called gratitude. And as the Vedic culture teaches, the cow, is there really life without ice cream? So, not life as we know it. So, I mean, the cow is just, as Prabhupada said, gives us these miracle foods, which you can't eat too much of. And so, why, and then, of course, the bull. We don't want to, forget the men here. We want to be gender equal. So the bulls, in non-industrial societies that are so primitive that they actually preserve nature. So the bull is plowing and the cow is giving us milk. So it's really kind of like this dynamite economic team, the cow and the bull. And so why would you kill them? Why would you kill them? In fact, not only do we not kill them, we honor them. Because it's a living being. It's a soul. It's a soul that's part of God. It's funny because there's one person in this country who was a political candidate in the past. And she has a child, I think, who has Down syndrome. And so it's like a big thing to show how religious and pious this person is. That even though this child really doesn't have normal human intelligence, still to love the child, to honor the child. You know, it's like a big thing. It shows your humanity. It shows your piety. And yet the same person loves to go up in helicopters and just, you know, and destroy large quantities of highly evolved mammals. So, I mean, what's up? What's up? It's this, rather than spiritualism, it's humanism. Humanism is a mundane concept. The fact that I honor you if you have a particular type of material body. So it's not about the soul for them. It's about what kind of body you have. And you can see, therefore, how that leads beautifully into racism, sexism. It's just like, you know, it's sort of like a seamless connection. Because you've established the principle, that you honor people not because they're part of God, not because they're souls, but because they have the right kind of body. And therefore, humanism is really on the same level as sexism or racism. Speciesism, it means that you strip someone of all their rights because they don't have the same kind of body you have. So we show gratitude to those who bestow upon us significant benefit. How could we not? And therefore, I think it's actually Krishna's arrangement. This is my own, probably called philosophical speculation. Mental speculation means you question whether or not what Krishna says is true. Prabhupada wrote me this in a letter when I was a young grihastha. He said, but philosophical speculation means you accept the statement as true and then you try to understand how it's true. So, for example, Krishna through his pure devotees, has created a spiritual system in which we honor a plant, Tulsi. We honor an animal, the cow. But by doing so, it actually opens our eyes to the fact that all life is sacred. Of course, Tulsi is a very special plant. The cow is a special animal. Still, it really is sort of like the gateway to a higher consciousness where we understand that all life is sacred. And there is a verse in the Bhagavatam, I can't quote the number here, although I am a Bhagavatam thumper, but there is a verse in the Bhagavatam where Krishna directly says that you cannot please me unless you honor all creatures. In fact, he says you should do puja to all, and again, honor. You should honor all creatures because every creature is part of God. Krishna says in the Gita, Mame vangsa jiva loke, every living being is part of me. So if I disrespect any living thing, I am disrespecting part of God. So if you say to someone, well, I patted you on the head, I just kicked your shin. I mean, the point is, every living being is part of God. So if I disrespect, if I offend any part of God, I'm offending God. And that's why the Bhagavatam also says, that one who archayam eva, if one only recognizes God in the deity form, and that is God, but if I only recognize Krishna there and don't recognize that every living body is a temple of God. Because why is this a temple? Because Krishna is here. But that same Krishna is in the heart of every living being. So that means every living body is a mandir. And therefore, the Bhagavatam says that if I don't recognize that, then I am a prakrita bhakta. I am a devotee on the material platform. Because I only recognize Krishna, well, he lives in this room. Of course, here in this room, just to make sure I'm not misunderstood, although I am kind of between controversies. So, that a temple is a place where everything is arranged to give you the best possible opportunity to connect with Krishna. So this is the best place to connect with Krishna, but this is where we practice sadhana bhakti. We practice seeing Krishna, so then we walk out the door, we keep the same consciousness. We take this temple consciousness everywhere, and we treat everyone we meet, every living thing, with temple consciousness, that you have Krishna within you. Anyway, maybe we'll stop here. And thank you all very much.
Hare Krishna. So prasadam is served.